Hello everyone and welcome to Celebrating Cinema. If you haven't already, please make sure to subscribe and leave a review. If you enjoy these conversations, share with a friend. If you haven't checked out our recent interviews, we have a great interview with Bertrand Bonello, done by Hugo, and myself with Balogi.
Hey.
Wow, that's so cool. Oh my God, big names, yo. Yeah.
We're getting there. As always, I'm joined by Hugo.
Hey, what's up?
Kirigo.
Hey, what's up?
And Mike.
Hi.
This is Mike Gomez, who is going to be joining us to discuss acting, actors on acting. He's an actor himself, but we always like to start by asking, what have you watched recently?
What have I watched? Last movie? I saw a movie yesterday. I saw Milk.
Yeah, oh, nice. Oh, nice. The Stephanie Cook film.
Yes.
How was the experience of watching it?
Yeah. I guess it was a bit, I felt isolated while I was watching that film. And I guess the reason is she does such a good job of isolating the character, even from the audience point of view, if we don't really understand or get to know what she's feeling as she's processing her grief.
Yeah.
Could you explain the plot just for anyone that hasn't seen it?
That's a good question. I'm trying to figure out the plot still. because it's quite simply a mother in the beginning of the film discovers she's going to birth a stillborn. And from then on, the family sort of does what they do to cope with this tragedy. The mother herself then begins to bottle producing the milk, breast milk, that her body's still making, in search of a family who needs it.
Wow.
And as I'm hanging on to, okay, this is a way to cope with what's happened with her in the film, at the same time, there's a distance between do we understand her or is there a necessity to understand her? In as much as this really weird, peculiar, you know, episode of I got to do something with my breast milk.
Yeah.
As much as that having that breast milk connects her to her child.
Kiriko, what have you seen?
I've seen a lot of good stuff. I watched, in terms of new films, I watched La Chimera, which touched me so profoundly. Yeah. I was like... it's really like a film that after watching it, you want to watch it immediately after again, because it has such a like incredible attention to detail that I find so rare. And last week I also saw a restoration that was done by the iFilm Institute of a 1919 film called The Dragon Painter, which is an American film, but a Japanese narrative with an almost entirely Japanese crew.
Oh, really?
And filmed, you know, completely in the States and super Hollywood style. But it was like a telenovela kind of vibey. And I understood the whole thing so easily from beginning to end, which, you know, to me is maybe also kind of rare from films of that time. So it was beautiful.
That's nice.
Yeah. How about you, Hugo?
Well, I saw the new film by Radu Jude, Do Not Expect Too Much from the End of the World. And he's one of my favorite contemporary filmmakers. Mm-hmm. He's a Romanian director who's so good at combining all of these seemingly desperate elements and making it this one huge essayistic, but also very personal and like cynical, but also funny kind of like journey through the hellscape of late capitalist Romania. And he's one of the most, I would say, astute, kind of intelligent filmmakers that really knows how to use all of these formats and ideas and put them into cinema as this kind of like living, essayistic, briefing kind of work. So that was, for me, movie of the year material for
nice.
Sure.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And you, Elliot?
Similar to you, I saw From Here to Eternity at the Eye. It's again a restoration, like a golden era Hollywood classic. And it's based or leads up to the Pearl Harbor attack. And it's got like Burt Lancaster in it. It's one of these sort of classic performances of like a military man sort of trying to decide between love for a woman or for his army and country.
But harsh.
Yeah, but there's something about the writing in like 1950s Hollywood that just, it's so like swift and on point all the time. That
and interesting, so like so shortly, basically after Pearl Harbor as well, right? Steeped in everybody's memory.
Yeah, interestingly, they don't necessarily focus on Pearl Harbor, but sort of more on the individual. So like the soldier within the army and whether the army loves them for everything they're doing. But I really enjoyed that. So today we're discussing actors and acting and sort of what the deal is, because I think we all kind of take it as a given, or we don't really seem to question too much acting on screen. We sort of know maybe when acting is really bad, but not necessarily when acting is good, or it often seems very natural to us. And it's to coincide with Marlon Brando and the program we're doing on him, sort of an icon of Hollywood cinema. And we've invited Mike to write something about acting.
Yeah, so I'll do my best.
Hit it off.
Let's go.
Standing on the shoulders of giants. Well, I just, overall, I mean, there's no getting around for myself feeling really pretentious and self-conscious and a bit vain.
Don't think about it. We're amongst friends here.
Awesome. Awesome. I'm an actor. I act in theater, on camera, but mostly, actually, I act a lot in my head. When I was 7, I once stayed up all night to watch and rewatch Seth Brundle, a lonely, misunderstood, smart dude, trying to seduce a young, confident journalist by introducing her to the world's greatest invention, teleportation. His big eyes, ear moves, and nervous charm soon gets interrupted when he steps into a telepod, sending the shock of seeing a common housefly locked inside with him. Disintegrating them as two and reintegrating them as one. That night I abandoned sleep forever and became the weirdest kid in Queens. David Cronenberg's The Fly became my favorite movie, and Jeff Goldblum's Brundlefly my favorite character. From then on, I learned what it was like to be Spider-Man, swinging through New York City. I pushed my skateboard like Marty McFly, pushing the pedal to 88 miles per hour in Doc Brown's DeLorean. I cried like the little boy crying inside Anton Fisher at Thanksgiving dinner. And I ran away as Simba when Mufasa took his last breath. I can't climb walls or travel back in time, but I can't connect with these dramas and adventures. They take me away from myself for a short while, and when I come back, I discover more of who I already am. An actor's work is literally play. Playing to believe the imagination of a story, to realize what can't be left to text and image alone. In our witness of this realization as an audience, we experience performance. There are many ways and techniques, rights and not quite rights, methods and tried truths in theatrical performance, classical or contemporary, devised and improvised, the coveted use of method acting to Meyerhold's biomechanics, kabuki theater and commedia dell'arte, German expressionism, and post-war modernism, Shakespeare, Stanislavski, Brecht, Adler, Meisner, Strasberg. Memory exercises to line repetitions, overdone rehearsals to cold single-take reads. Whatever the means of a performer, the process and work are masked under whom we meet as characters. Characters that leave us warm and estranged, reminding us to call our parents. Characters denying pain, revealing our underloved and bleeding parts. Characters stealing our hearts, making us blush in classroom daydreams. Characters falling over and over again, reaching out a hand to the losers we feel like sometimes. Characters struggling to keep it together. Characters we hold our breath for. Characters full of love and humor, inviting us to forgive and smile a bit more. Characters born in darkness. Characters we run and hide from. Characters that break our hearts and sour our eyes. Characters we cry for. Characters we cry with. Characters out of this world, reminding us to be human. Characters standing up for something. Characters so cool, so smooth, we imitate them in the bathroom mirror. Characters so natural, so subtle, we forget their characters at all. It's in all these characters we mostly see ourselves, and in all the actors who play them that mostly show us truth. Suspending disbelief for a couple of hours, we enjoy the elaborate lies movies tell us to experience truth in imaginary circumstances. In these stories, we realize the importance of our big, tiny, boring, and fantastic lives. Given the crazy job of communicating who we all are to what Sir Laurence Olivier once said, silly masochistic exhibitionists, or simply said, actors. One of the most celebrated actors of all time, if not the most, for curating such a variety of lives in these characters is Marlon Brando. Honoring his 100th birthday, this episode of Celebrating Cinema gives a nod to the art of acting, and more than the actors who played them, let's highlight some on-screen characters that have made the whole dang fuss of movie making worthwhile.
Wow, so good.
Just sweet love letter.
Yeah.
Oh, I got it done. Nice.
How was that writing for you?
Yeah, it was quite hard because it's such a big thing. And not just, I guess, personally, my relationship with acting, but what is it? How do we approach it? And for me, it always comes from a place of movies, as far as that's what got me into acting. That's what I love. And yeah, what do we say about the actors or about what we witnessed them performing?
Well, I have one more question for you because, you know, at the beginning of the Cold Open, you mentioned all these early inspirations, right? All these characters that made you fantasize and play act as a kid. But can you maybe give us some insight on some of the characters and also the actors behind the characters that are a driving force of inspiration for you right now as a professional?
Oh, yeah. Wow. Also a very big question.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the ones that I fell in love with as a kid still hold true. Jeff Goldblum, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Jack Nicholson is a big one of them. Denzel. Willem Dafoe. Big Willem Dafoe. And I haven't seen her recently, but Julianne Moore, I love.
Mm.
I think she was so great, especially in all the PTA films. And you mentioned something before we started recording about how we watch these actors throughout their career.
Yeah.
And seeing them progress and age on screen and how that changes who they get to portray on screen. And I'm always constantly invigorated by the new actors, I guess, that we see.
Mm-hmm.
Or, the new talent. And I think most recently who I've really, really liked is Florence Pugh.
Mm.
She's getting, of course, a lot of big-time Hollywood shine with her performances. But there's something captivating about her, and that's this effortlessness. You know, you pointed out, Elliot, what we don't necessarily see what good acting is, but we automatically see what bad acting is.
Mm.
That's such a hard thing to do,
yeah,
to be completely natural in front of a camera, especially when you're filming a movie around 100 crew members and things are so big and there's a lot of weight on your shoulders to get things done and right. But to play it as if there's nothing else happening around you. And I think she's one of those actors who nails that, you know, every time. So that's quite nice.
Yeah. I have a question for all of you guys, because as a non-actor, as we are, mm-hmm. except for you, earlier you said something in your cold open, which really resonated with me, is that those actors that you see throughout your life in some way mirror the character that you create for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you guys have characters or maybe actors who you've seen and then aspire to be, who then became a part of who you are today.
Well, I remember, and it's not like an aspirational thing, but just kind of like this mirroring that was the first time that it felt so uncanny that I was just kind of like in shock, was when I saw Richard Linklater's Boyhood.
You guys ready to have some fun?
Yeah!
All right, don't worry about it.
Wish I could use the bumpers.
You don't want the bumpers. Life doesn't give you bumpers.
We have a new student joining us today.
Hey, dude. Welcome to the suck.
But that's also because, like, my parents were divorced, and this is a film that takes place over a decade, and protagonist of Boyhood, his parents go through a divorce, and then you see that kind of like long winding journey of his adolescence, and that coincided exactly with me becoming of like a young adult age. So it was, I guess, the most uncannily one-on-one, and then Linklater in his films also has this totally naturalistic portrayal of his characters. That also has this like lived in effortlessness that you almost forget, like you said in your cold open, that there are characters at all. So that was the first time where I was like, really, what the fuck? And then I think, strangely enough, the other one definitely was Elijah Wood as Frodo Baggins. That was kind of like,
hell yeah.
That's cute.
As a young boy, that was like, you know, I mean, what was it? It was like 2001, I think, when Fellowship of the Ring got released. So I was like 8. And then you see this, like, he's not a kid, you know, he's an adult in those films, but the world treats him as a kid. And then you're like, Jesus, man, that's like the weight of the world also on his shoulders. That was aspirational, actually. Like, I remember always this line where, like, they say, like, even the smallest or least significant person can change the course of the world. And when you're an 8-year-old boy, you're like, holy fuck. And the way that like Elijah does internalizes all of these things. I think that one was probably the most formative movie role I've ever seen in my life.
Profound.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. You, Kiriko? I still need to think.
Okay. Well, I think for me, as a child, and I think more so as a teenager, I think I had a very conflicted relationship with my being Asian-ness, because I'm half Japanese. So I think I reflected my own persona to the Asians that I saw on screen, and then primarily to Asian women who sort of found strength or sort of like a sense of savage in who they were. So the first people who come to mind are Lucy Liu in Charlie's Angels and Gogo Yubari in Kill Bill.
Gogo, I know you feel you must protect your mistress, but I beg you, walk away.
I had a poster of her hanging in my in my bedroom. Yeah. Well, not very, because she's cool, but she's also kind of horrible and heartless.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I guess that's what you look for as a teen, or at least I do.
Yeah, I would imagine you were a badass teen. If
not necessarily. No, I was trying to
be. It's like what you said. You want to imagine yourself that you can be a badass teen,
exactly.
But most teens actually are not.
Yeah.
They're all kind of.
You try to be.
I think mine is probably similar to you in that also I'm half Indian. And Dev Patel in Slumdog Millionaire.
Welcome to Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
On the world's biggest game show, how does a boy from the slums know all the answers?
Are you nervous?
Am I nervous?
Oh, yes.
While I didn't really necessarily have a similarity to him, I think just seeing someone that looked similar to me or someone that I was familiar with do look so cool on screen, to me at least, I think really impacted me and sort of made me, I don't know, I guess wanted to aspire to come across like him, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
There's like a saying in the Indian community now that you can either be a doctor, a lawyer, or Dev Patel.
Dev Patel.
So,
have you seen his new film, by the way?
No,
that he directed,
I really want to
already
see it. Yeah, Monkey Man.
Yeah.
Have you?
No, I haven't. No. But it's so interesting. Yeah. Speaking of actors and how they want to be, you know, portrayed, that sometimes they have to take the initiative in their own hands and make the film that they want to star in because they're not getting the roles.
Mm.
Yeah.
It is interesting, though, that, you know, all of us then immediately go towards the representation of a bit of ourselves, even on the most, like let's say, seemingly essential or basic aspect of ourselves, you know, the way that we look, our kind of like origins, our background and stuff. But then maybe if we can go one step deeper, what are some of the characters that maybe less resemble yourself but still capture something essential that you are like touched by or something?
So I can go immediately because I think of instantly Bicycle Fees by Vittoria De Sica. And it's actually the kid, Bruno, and he must be no more than 6 or 8. And this kid never acted in anything since that. But yet he was able to convey so much pain, but yet trying to be older than he was to support his family because... So the film's about his father who loses his bike and it stops him from working. And it's all about this kid carrying a pain in him that he knows what his father's lost, but still trying to be strong enough for him or to try and help him in some way, where I guess that resonates with the sense of you're growing up sooner than you expect to feel. And also the kid in Cinema Paradiso as well. There's something about young Italian actors that, that really gets to me.
Really resonates with me.
Yeah.
These Italians, they get you every time. Yeah. Like, but neorealism is a cheat in that sense. It's like the cheat codes to come in, like lurching towards your heart because it's so direct.
What about you, Mike?
Yeah, I really, really resonate with what you just said. You know, these like kids or people put in a position where they have to take on more responsibility than they should. And my mind goes to what's eating Gilbert Grape.
Andorra. It's a town where nothing much ever happens. This is where I live with my family.
Doctor said we'd be lucky if Arnie lived to be 10.
I could go at any time.
Arnie, don't be rude.
Some days you want him to live?
I kill him, Gilbert.
I know, buddy.
Okay, son, come down now.
Bye!
Some days you don't.
When is this gonna stop?
And then there's Mama.
That's my mom in there.
If nothing ever happens here.
It's those lobsters, isn't it?
Why does it always happen to me?
And Johnny Depp in that movie,
He
plays such a, you know, a very soft-spoken, keeping the pain of what's happening in his family and being the outcast in the town inside while carrying the burden of making sure that everybody's going to be okay at the end of the day. You know, and his performance was really strong. And he's one of those actors, I think, for me, that witnessing him at such an age, I immediately was like, I got to be this guy. I got to be him. And of course, as his career progressed, he started taking on these heavily, fictional character kind of roles. He wanted to break away from that whole Hollywood leading man kind of image that he had. But I guess it's those characters that have experienced or are very close to a loss of a really personal relationship in their lives. And then you kind of are witnessing their journey afterwards.
The actors or the characters?
I would say the characters. And it's funny because, you know, we have, typecast. Everyone gets typecast in some way. And we tend to view the best of actors as someone you can't put in a box because they tend to be chameleons and can become anybody. We can't see who they are as a person in their role. I think, and maybe this is me as an actor speaking, that's impossible. You know, you cannot not be you, and no matter what you do, the same way in which we kind of imitate the characters or the actors, that have a big impact on us. It's vice versa. We can't help but put in to whatever character,
a
bit of ourselves, because it's not coming from anywhere else. It's coming from you.
Mm-hmm. But isn't that also the part where it becomes so difficult to talk about acting in the first place? Because no matter what you do, I agree with you, you are unable to disconnect the person from the character that they are portraying. But therefore also, you immediately have an interest or a judgment or some form of opinion upon someone's personal either life or experience or age, and therefore we have this also absurd fascination with actors as the only people within the process of the creation of film that we feel the need, as if we need to know who they are, which I personally also have that fascination profoundly with some actors, but when I think about it, I always feel, disgusted about it in some way.
I can relate it to my work, as you know, a film journalist, and going to a lot of film festivals and doing a lot of interviews. And occasionally, you know, in Cannes, there's a new movie with American actors in it. And then I want to, usually for the magazine that I write for, I want to interview the director, right? Because those are the people usually with the ideas about the film and kind of like the whole conception of the film usually comes from them, especially in this kind of art house segment, right? And then occasionally they slot you in with the actors as well, and you have to do round table interviews with the actors, and it just becomes an entirely different conversation. And some of them are very annoying because you can just see that the actors are kind of like it becomes a lifestyle thing, it becomes a personal thing, it becomes about their celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
But occasionally they are brilliant, and they expand your ideas about what the film is and the characters are and the way that they carry it. Some of those actors are like Juliette Binoche and Isabelle Huppert and a couple of others that really kind of like carry a part of actually the artistic project of the film within themselves. And
mm-hmm.
to get a little bit of that essence is invigorating and very exciting, but it is not always the case. So I definitely see that tension for sure.
Yeah, this is for movies overall, right? It's such an industry, and with actors, the art of acting, and then there's the business of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the business part, they, you know, most actors, as they build their brand, so to speak, yeah, they become a product or a celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to separate that from their acting, as well as who are they as a person.
Yeah, but I think also as a viewer, I'm not able, or I don't want to disconnect the one from the other. Or yeah. I of course can think about why Marlon Brando is a phenomenal actor. But yesterday I had the great privilege to rewatch Apocalypse Now.
You've heard of Colonel Walter E. Kurtz? Your mission is to terminate the Colonel's command.
Terminate?
Terminate with extreme prejudice.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
And, you know, knowing that I was going to talk about him today, I was sort of like focusing on his acting presence within that film, which is like relatively brief. And mm-hmm. it's also not giving that much. But still somehow I'm like so impressed the moment he gets on the screen. And then I thought a huge part of this is because I just find this man so beautiful and fascinating. Mm-hmm. Like I cannot not find him gorgeous when I look at him in a film, and that is means so much to me as a viewer as well. Yeah. And also, you know, the idea that I know him in some way or another, or that I'm so familiar with the contours of his face or something. It's kind of disgusting, but
and
also why
film,
I love
that
it.
That film is entirely about the contours of his face as well.
Exactly.
So it actually
yeah.
indulges you in it as well. It invites you to explore every aspect of his face, which is very beautifully done.
Yeah.
Should we explain a bit about why Marlon Brando is so famous? Because maybe there are, or so well regarded for his acting, because I'm sure there, like with our film club we did, we found out that a lot of people haven't seen 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Oh, yeah.
I'm also sure there are people listening that may never have watched The Godfather or Apocalypse Now or On the Waterfront.
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody instead of a bum, which is what I am. Let's face it.
Does someone want to sort of explain what makes Marlon Brando so captivating?
Do you
want to
take
watch?
A crack at
that? I'm going to try, man. I'm going to try. What makes him so captivating? I mean, he's such a big influence on many of, I want to say, what new Hollywood actors are. And that's like, you know, from the mid-60s onward. And how these young generation of actors and directors came in and really changed the Hollywood system as far as what kind of movies were being produced. And everything leaned into more realistic, natural, and real stories anchored in, let's say, what Marlon Brando brings or brought to the screen was a loss of self-consciousness, right? I think before that, a lot of actors appeared in films, and it was very theatrical. It was almost as if they were still on stage with exaggerated expressions and very static sort of movements. Whereas him, he embodies the behavior of somebody who is not in front of a camera, somebody who's really in that place. And that, I think, really inspired a lot of actors, even myself included, because it's like that's who I want to be. I just want to be as me as possible in performance, in as much as I'm hiding behind a character. And, you know, to your point, Carrico, I think he has such a charisma and energy, and maybe it's because of the way he performs, that you just want to see more and you want to know more.
I think additionally, it's like that energy and that charisma, you always feel that it is dangerous as well. I have that with him a lot, and it's like, and then that gets fused with the off-screen, you know, individual, the celebrity, the man, but also with the characters that he portrays on screen. It's like alluring, but you know that it can be a deadly trap as well. And I think that kind of like, you know, cinema always is about this like dichotomy between being mobile and immobile, about sitting still but being drawn into something, right? And feeling that you're getting drawn into something that is dangerous is one of the biggest pleasures of watching films. And I think somehow he was the perfect embodiment of that or something.
Yeah, I know what you mean. His silence, right, spoke a thousand words, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And that's powerful.
Yeah, he's a powerful person to look at. Yeah.
I also think often the best actors are the ones that have less to say, but more in just how they carry themselves mm-hmm. on screen.
But would you say that he has ever played a role in which he was a character who did not embody this beautiful danger? Did he ever get the chance?
Yeah, that's a very good question.
Because maybe it's also the way he's then casted, you know? He started his career off in that way, and then people understood that it worked and that's something that we want to see.
But maybe, do you think he's also, in that sense, curating the characters he wants to play because he sees himself only in certain characters rather than...
Or he's only asked by directors for that?
Yeah. Well, I know the story of him on the set of The Score, I think, which is, who else does that star?
Oh, that was
star?
Ed Norton, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And there, this is like 2001, so this is like late stage Brando, and he's like this megalomaniac, you know, character off screen as well. And he was actually kind of like taking over the entire directing job of the film because he had his ideas of how he wanted to be directed when he was acting. So, for instance, he wanted a particular kind of close-up on his face. And the stories go that he would just then come on set without any pants on so that there wouldn't be a wide shot of him, so that it would be a close-up on his face because then the filmmakers didn't have a choice, you know, of how to show him. So definitely I think this powerful, commanding thing is, I think, if, like in his case, a thing that he co-opted. And I've once seen, forgive me for being vague, but I've once seen a documentary about Marlon Brando that uses all of these kind of like voice diary clips that he had.
Yeah.
And you get like a really interesting insight in this paranoid, tortured mind a lot as well. So I don't know, like he's like the other greys, often a quite problematic figure. So.
Yeah, I think it's you cannot separate it. I think there's a way that he viewed himself as an actor, as a person, that he put into his work, as well as how everybody else saw him and wanted him for certain things and certain roles. It's almost impossible to separate the person. We can't, you know, in this documentary that you mentioned, it's all these voice recordings that he took himself just at home monologuing throughout his day, but they were so disconnected, I would say, you know, the rambling of who he was as a person, but it shines light on how he thought.
It's it's given a little bit Nixon recording himself in the White House vibes. Weirdly enough, they feel like kind of like related characters in a strange way.
Do you think we also underestimate how much it takes out of an actor to give themselves to a character, and also how a character may also stay with them, or parts of a character may stay with them? Because I also think of Seymour Hoffman, who seemed conflicted and troubled, but then a lot of his roles were also about that, which I think may kind of enable the two, if that makes sense.
I have one recent anecdote from Bertrand Bonello, who I interviewed about The Beast, which is a film starring Léa Seydoux in three different time eras, and she's in all of them. She's basically in every single scene almost. And the film, Bonello describes it, it's a film about this sci-fi story, but it's also a film about Léa Seydoux, right?
Yeah.
But he explained that she's the type of character that just basically doesn't prepare. She like reads the script maybe once, and then she comes on set and she's like, okay, what are we going to do today?
Wow.
And he explains her like, now you're doing this and then you're going to cry. And then she just does everything. And then after that, it's gone, you know?
Yeah.
So in her case, she doesn't that much carry the weight of the characters.
Yeah.
It's just an innate thing that is inside of her, which is insane to think about if you've seen the film, because the film is so tremendously emotionally powerful.
Yeah.
So it can exist that it's not there, but maybe you have some stories of how you deal with that.
Oh man, I think that's so, it's great that you pointed out Léa Seydoux, because in her case, right, as far as her process, what we know about it, it's this, okay, I'm here, let's do it.
Yeah.
Right? And I think a lot of actors have that. Or you have the people who say, okay, I've got this role. I'm going to dedicate the next year of my life becoming this person, like your Daniel Day-Lewis's, mm-hmm. your Joaquin Phoenix's. And everyone's going to be different on how they do that. Mm-hmm. I think towards the end of Brando's career, he was doing this. He wouldn't even read scripts.
Yeah.
He would just ask how much.
Yeah.
And then he'd show up to set, he'd place the script on someone's chest, his lines, and then go from there.
Huh.
That was it. Yeah. He was even doing that from Godfather. He was doing
just this. Winging it.
Just winging it.
You look, pal, I want you to rest well, and a month from now, this Hollywood big shot's going to give you what you want.
It's too late. They start shooting in a week.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
I think the prep he did was put
the cotton balls.
Yeah. He started with cotton swabs in his mouth. To look like a bulldog, and then that was it.
I've seen those. Oh, yeah. They're in the Academy Museum in Los Angeles. Yeah.
Oh my!
That's kind of like all those kind of like Christian artifacts, you know, these like handkerchiefs,
yeah, exactly.
Like,
I'm sure
fingers of like dead saints and stuff. But I've seen those. So I've been close to the brilliance of his acting.
It's incredible. I think as far as the extent. Whether it's, completely deep diving into what you think a person should be or is, to just, oh, it's acting. Why do I have to become this person? I can just pretend.
And how does that relate to the dynamic with the director? Because there's this funny anecdote of Matt Damon on the set of Clint Eastwood's Invictus. And they're shooting a scene. And yeah, of course I have to go to Clint Eastwood. But Clint Eastwood is one of my favorite directors as well.
Oh, as a director? Oh, he's good.
So there's this scene and they do a take, and then Matt Damon, he comes to Eastwood. It's a film about Nelson Mandela and about rugby in South Africa and stuff. It's not one of the greats of Eastwood, but it's a funny movie. And then Matt Damon comes to Eastwood after they do the take, and he's like, oh, Mr. Eastwood, can we do another one? I think I can do it a bit better. And then Eastwood pats him on the shoulder, and he's like, why would you waste everybody's time, son? next shot. And I love this idea as well, like that the director can also dictate how the actor should act, sure. Right?
Yeah.
For sure. And I think this is particularly true with films versus theater mm-hmm. for an actor, because there's action cut, and it's on the director to determine whether he's got his shot or not.
But that must be so horrible to work with certain actors. I once spoke with a friend of mine who was in one of Dutch directors, Alex van Warmerdam's mm-hmm. films. And he is known for directing in a way that you're taught as a director not to direct. So literally say the sentences and tell the actor where the intonation of every single word should be, which mm-hmm. as an actor leaves you to... no creativity, because that's the least power you have, you know,
to
say your words. But still, you know, they're fabulous films. So
mostly also because of the acting, which
exactly.
is insanely good.
Yeah, exactly.
With a lot of movies, it's, you know, maybe it's a bit crude to say, but actors are props.
Yeah.
You know, especially if a director has such a strict vision for what he wants, how he wants it done, and the actor's just someone who knows, who looks the part. You know, you have this experience where it's just, no, I don't want that. I want you to say it exactly like this, and then we got it. And like for the actor, it's like, what the hell am I doing here? You know, why don't you just get the grip to come in and do this? What am I adding to it? Which is why it's particular, and I think hard, because again, it's you want, a lot of actors just won't work. They just mm-hmm. want to get in front of a camera. They just want to be on the screen. So the process of how they're able to do whatever it is that they want to do is partially dependent upon how much permission they have.
But then you have the opposite kind of direction, which is what, you know, Terrence Malick in his later stage of his career used much more, where he would just have these open sets and the camera can go everywhere. And then he wouldn't give people acting directions or cues very much per se, but he would give them like almost little inscriptions on pieces of papers, almost riddles and little things to think about. almost like the oblique strategy cards of Brian Eno, these little things that just open up a little like hatch in somebody's brain, and then they would have to sit with those, also kind of randomized, so people are just thinking about these things, and then the camera goes through them and things happen and stuff, which is a very, I can assume, disorienting experience. And there's a lot of film actors that never want to work with Terry again. I think Christopher Plummer was like one of the most famous ones, that he was like, after being on the set of The New World, he was like, I'm never going to work with Malick again. But then others actually want, other actors want to work with Terrence Malick to understand a different view on acting versus directing. And many of those people then later start making their own movies because they want to see the process and have a various scope of how directors work. So it's kind of like this rite of passage almost for a lot of actors to work with Terrence Malick. But it's like almost crippling freedom for others, you know?
I guess that's just tough. What is it? You know, a part of the whole experience of I get this chance to work with this director. I've heard terrible things about him. I'm not going to do it. Versus, oh man, this guy's so innovative. I've never approached my work like this before. I want to try it, kind of thing.
What is for you the allure to act? Why do you love it?
Well, who says I love it?
Mm-hmm. Well, why do you do it?
Why do I do it?
Yeah, what's your deal, man?
What's your deal, man? Yeah, I ask myself that all the time. I think partially it's because the time I get to be with myself when I'm not, performing. A big part of it, has to do with who I am as a person. I'm very introverted and I overthink things. And in this way, when I get an opportunity to perform, whatever that character might be, it allows me to, I guess, go into this internal space where I can find something that I haven't seen before in myself. It's a challenge. It's scary sometimes. And it is, masochistic. There's something I enjoy, the pain of not knowing and the uncertainty. And it's fun at the end of the day because it makes me feel like when I was a kid and I was just role-playing or pretending to be some superhero. And committing to that so much so that I believe it, only to be told, you know, the streetlights are coming on, it's time to go inside. Oh, All right, we could do that.
Well, I have one question because it relates to Marlon Brando. You know, another thing about Marlon Brando is he knew how to sell tickets. You know, he was like a box office magnet. And he inspired a whole slew, a new generation of actors that were somewhat the same. Al Pacino, Robert De Niro, Gene Hackman, James Caan, a zillion others that I'm forgetting, but also at some point Denzel Washington, Jack Nicholson, the list goes on. You know, there's some of these guys, and it's usually mostly guys, right, that are like built on the poster of a film. People go and see the film. In the last 10 years or so, there's been a lot of articles about the dad of the conventional movie star coinciding with the dad of kind of like the big original mainstream blockbuster productions. Brad Pitt is not a huge bankable star as he used to be. Johnny Depp isn't either, you know. Are there still thespian actors in cinema that can sell out movie screenings just for the virtue of showing up? Or is that also like a dying thing?
But is it true that actors are not able to carry the box office?
Well, many journalists write about it. I'm asking the question because of what we think of it.
I think it's maybe evolved, or maybe evolved is the wrong word, but changed into something I personally don't like, where it's more influencer-based in the sense that Zendaya and Timothy Chalamet, they're actors, and we can discuss whether how great they are, but they are box office draws. Like, I think people will go and watch a film if their name's attached to it. And I think it's now moving to that space as well. Like Sydney Sweeney as well. While I do enjoy some of her acting, I think, again, people rely on the fact that she has a wide audience, and that social media influence is now something that attracts people to come watch a film rather than, say, if it was Denzel Washington.
But are they social media?
Well, persona? I think it goes hand in hand. Like, they've become famous through their acting, but now because the way they're marketed and their branding, right. they then have such
a... Which is, of course, also a universal kind of like thing in Hollywood, but it has changed. I think the phase of it has changed.
I don't know what you guys think of that. If
Well, I think you make a good point about social media. It's just we have so much more access to actors and who they are now versus the time before it, where you needed to go to the cinema to get
to
a bit more.
Faces.
And... Yeah, the movie stars are changing. It's not what it used to be at all, right? Maybe I'll go see a Timothée Chalamet film, right? What Dune was just released, and it's big. The biggest A-listers on this movie. But I probably am going to go see that because I want to see Josh Brolin. You know, I want to see Javier Bardem. And these are still big movie stars for me. Right, because maybe their legacies, right? They've had such.
They have had already the chance to prove how big of a star they are, or something like.
And the movies that they've been in have not only been probably box office hits, but also very good. And I think the quality of the films as well, and not just the quality of the acting, adds to the whole of I need to see this person.
Who is an actor that you? If that actor plays in a film, you will definitely go see it. Like,
wait, well, I have one funny anecdote that I wanted to share. It's not the actor for me, but I think the reason that I ask this question is because it also ties into a kind of like segmentation of the audience, purposed audience of a film. And I program a small cinema in a municipal theater in IJmuiden, which is like the harbor city outside of Amsterdam. And our main audience is... basically elderly people, you know, they're like 60-somethings. And we can show a new film with younger actors and people don't necessarily come to it. But we recently screened a film starring Anthony Hopkins. Forgive me for forgetting the name, but it's this film where Anthony Hopkins, he saved a lot of people during the Holocaust and they like... they kind of like surprise him with a lot of the survivors that he saved and they have this thing and it's kind of like it's a very geriatric World War II remembrance movie starring a very old Anthony Hopkins. And it was a box office smash.
Really?
Like people come from all over town to watch that movie. Suddenly there's like 200 people on a Tuesday afternoon watching a film starring Anthony Hopkins. And I was like, this is one of the last guys I think that can draw in that audience for that generation. And I was kind of like very surprised by that, but also like pleasantly surprised, but it's still this kind of weird realization. Like he can still do that. That's insane. It's one of the most successful films we ever screened.
Wow.
And I think it's only by virtue of it being Anthony Hopkins on the bill.
Because I think of other, like Leonardo DiCaprio, I don't know if now people would still go. Ryan Gosling, maybe. But then he made, what's that film, The Stuntman?
Stuntman, yeah.
Yeah, but the only person that maybe comes to mind is Joaquin Phoenix.
Yeah,
just because,
that's what I was thinking about.
Yeah, just because you know he perhaps will take on different roles.
But most of them do have that Brando allure of beauty and danger. Sure. That's funny. Yeah.
And it's a lot of like, there, most of those, you know, like, with my dad, you know, when I would watch movies with him, it was all the tough guy movies, you know. We would only watch Pacino movies, Eastwood movies, De Niro movies. Like, that's why Heat...
Let's go.
That's why Heat still one of greatest movies ever made.
Yes.
Because it's Al Pacino and Robert De Niro in the same fucking shot.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that was such a... moment of cinema.
Yeah, for sure.
Right? Like bringing these two together, heavy hitters together, heavyweights in acting.
It's lightning in a bottle, you know, that's what it sometimes is.
Yeah.
Is there an actor you would go see just for their name? No.
I think for me, Robert Pattinson.
Yeah.
Just because it ticks all my boxes of the things that I love. So I originally fell in love with him because he was beautiful.
Shout out Twilight.
Shout out to Twilight.
You can listen to our Twilight episodes.
But then from there on, he... I don't know. I think he tried to follow a same path that I try to follow in life. So I feel very like related to him in the sense that it becomes personal or something. No, he really takes his acting in a like technically as a craft very seriously, because mm-hmm. he really dares to challenge himself and aspires to be the actor who can take on the many roles.
I recently saw a bit of Good Time again, and oh my God. He's so insanely good in that.
He's so good.
And he's actually, I interviewed the Softies about that film, and wow. then he stepped into the room, and it was like the air was sucked out of the room. It was insane. And like, I'm not usually very starstruck, but I was like, holy shit. And also at the same time, I was like, I want to hang out with this dude so badly. He's yeah. so cool. Like, it's yeah. insane. Yeah.
Yeah. He's such a weirdo also. And then to also like go for the regular path of doing a Batman, I find that also so fitting. And I admire his career choices.
He is someone that has perhaps been able to change the narrative of his career.
Yeah,
for sure.
He tries very hard and he succeeded. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You, Hugo, is that someone you would always go and see?
Yeah, I think it might also be Robert Pattinson. But I'm going to be on the record and be very brave and say I'm now also a Sydney Sweeney stan. So I will definitely see every Sydney Sweeney film ever made. But that's for ulterior motives as well. She's quite attractive. Yeah,
that was my next question. Why? Yeah. I don't see it. Oh man, that's tough. It's like the OGs. I'll always go see the OGs. You know, I'll go see Denzel any day of the week. I just love watching him on screen, kind of thing. You know, De Niro and Pacino don't make movies like that anymore, and most of them are these weird romantic comedies that De Niro's appearing in.
Well, The Intern, the Nancy Meyers film with De Niro, is actually a banger. It is a genius movie.
You're right. Yeah. That was very good.
One of his last great movies. One of his last great ones.
It's true. As far as contemporary acts today, I think Tom Hardy. Mm. I'll go watch him because he's definitely this Brando-esque actor, let's say. Very brooding, you know, tough, and he portrays those roles for sure.
What has he been doing though lately?
Actually, he was like in a jiu-jitsu championship fight.
Oh yeah, like he's apparently very talented in jiu-jitsu.
Exactly. Yeah. He's been doing that with his life.
Good. That's good.
sounds very healthy.
But is there anything else we want to add before we wrap it up?
Well, maybe that it's okay to love an actor for their beauty.
Yeah.
I think that's important to say because it feels like we're always so, I mean, of course we love good quality, but it's also so important to fall in love with people on the screen or something. I don't know.
And I want to also, as we say in Dutch, break a lance for Sydney Sweeney, because if you've seen the film Reality, that's such a tremendous film that takes place in a single location with only a handful of actors in real time, kind of like maps out this thing, this conflict surrounding the character of Sydney Sweeney. Her name is Reality, and she was a whistleblower for NSA or something like that in the States. And it's a terrifying film, and she carries the entire film. She's a tremendous actress. So I just wanted to say that. But I also agree that, like, yeah, that we should also watch people on the big screen for their beauty, because that's very pleasurable as well.
Well, with that, I think we can wrap up. I think hopefully by listening to this conversation, you've understood a little bit more about the art of acting and just how complex it is. Mike, thank you for sharing with us.
Yeah, thank you so much, Mike.
Thank you, guys. This is an honor.
We hope to have you again. If you're interested about acting and actors, you can listen to our recent episode on the enigmatic Nicolas Cage, but also an older episode on Tilda Swinton,
the comedian,
someone we didn't discuss, but I think we cover her very well on an older episode. If you haven't already, please make sure to like and subscribe, leave a review, share with friends. This was a Lab 111 production, produced and edited by myself, music from Hugo Emazel, and artwork by Studio FFF.